Hello, I'm Andrew Scrivani.
And I'm Chef John. Welcome to the Chef John Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Chef John Podcast.
How are you doing?
We're heading into like the fall now, and I'm feeling really good about it. I love it. I like where we are. You know, this is my favorite time of year. I'll be giving surf reports pretty soon as the Atlantic storm season starts to kick in and the waves start to get bigger out my front door here. So that's technically not a weather report.
No, that's a surf report.
That's right. It's adjacent to weather.
That's for people that find weather reports a little too scintillating.
I don't want to overstimulate people at the beginning of the show.
And that sounds totally safe, surfing in those conditions, by the way.
Hey, listen, it's safer than surfing where you live.
Well, that's true.
The last time I tried to surf where you live, they closed the beaches for shark attacks.
Well, yeah. And then there's what got them? The shark, the surf, the riptide? No, hypothermia. You could literally die out here surfing just... And nothing goes wrong. You just got too cold.
We'll dedicate another show to surfing one day when we get John out on the surfboard, which will be, I don't know, about 1,000 years from now. So if we're still around doing the podcast in 2122, then we'll talk about that.
And speaking of surfing, if you're ever surfing the internet, Andrew has some great suggestions for places you could stop, maybe, you know, they focus on the Chef John Podcast, where you could leave us some feedback.
That was a professional segue. So what John was saying was, if you are going to be surfing the internet, you need to be visiting us at Chef John Pod on Twitter or Instagram. We love your comments. We love your suggestions. So please keep them coming. And when you get to your podcast platform of choice, what we need is what, John?
A 5-star rating and a few words of wisdom or just words of nonsense. Really doesn't matter. But yes, we would like you to give us a 5-star rating if you feel so inclined. And as always, besides enjoy, leave a couple words of encouragement or criticism or suggestions. That is our virtual suggestion box. And unlike most suggestion boxes, which are just, you know, decoration in the office, we actually do read these. And every once in a while, we adjust our programming accordingly.
That's right. And you can leave us a message on our website, thechefjohnpodcast.com. Or even better, you can call us and leave a voicemail, and we may feature it on a future show. We also really encourage you to share with your friends, because it's really important that we spread the word about the Chef John Podcast. Send a link to somebody you love, because you know what? Sending the Chef John Podcast is a love language.
If you can't spam your friends and family, who can you spam these days?
So our first segment is Run It Up the Pole, Breakfast Edition. We sent some polls out to Twitter and Instagram about morning drinks and morning cravings. And we're going to talk to you about what we found out about all of you.
I love this segment.
It's one of my favorites because, quite honestly, it's just something I don't have to write during the week.
And by the way, this is your first Chef John Podcast. I'm kidding. Andrew's not kidding. Please proceed.
We talk about polls. John makes some
poll puns,
innuendos, all kinds of things like that. And then we move on to the actual polling, which I will get to right now. So we sent a poll out that asked you about your morning drink, and we gave you options of coffee, tea, soda, or other. And the others that came in were things like Red Bull, water, water, electrolyte flavor packets. But overwhelmingly, John, what do you think the answers were?
Well, first of all, I don't see beer on here. I guess that would be other. I'm guessing coffee came in with a strong showing at number one.
Absolutely. On both Twitter and Instagram, coffee came in at 73 and 77% respectively.
Wow. And you know what I like about our polls, unlike a lot of the online polls, ours are almost never shocking or surprising.
No, not at all.
You could pretty much, without looking at the poll, just tell us what the results are and you'd be within 5%.
That's very true.
There's no surprise here. Coffee, 73%. I mean, I guess 12% tea. So apparently roughly 10 to 12% of our audience is British, I guess. Very, very interesting poll, allegedly.
Well, it is definitely consistent with what I would perceive as the morning drinks that I am familiar with and the ones that I have indulged in mostly. So here's a little insider baseball on me. You know me to be a voracious coffee consumer. I drink a lot of coffee throughout the day, particularly black espresso, as per my Italian roots. But here's a little tidbit for you. I didn't have a single cup of coffee until I was over 30 years old.
Really? That is surprising. I started at about age, I'm going to say 3 or 4, literally. My grandparents would do the watered down or milked down coffee, and we'd eat it with Ritz crackers. And that was a very traditional grandma and grandpa are babysitting for us breakfast. And I couldn't figure out why I felt so good afterward, even though it was only, you know, maybe 4 ounces of this stuff and not a super high amount of caffeine. But I guess at that body weight, it hits you like 3 cups of coffee for an adult. So yeah, I remember very early age, an appreciation for coffee. The one stat here, I was surprised that soda wasn't higher. Soda is almost equal with tea, 10 to 12 respectively, but Diet Coke seems to be a fairly popular breakfast morning, get myself going drink.
Yeah, I would agree with that. How about a hybrid here? How about Manhattan Special? Were you a Manhattan Special guy?
No, I've never heard of it.
What? This is the difference between New York City and upstate New York.
I was going to say, I spent 1 week a year in New York City. So,
okay. So Manhattan Special is coffee soda. And it was something that was in every Italian household I ever grew up around. And this was sometimes a substitute for morning coffee.
Was it a substitute for Yahoo?
No, Yoo-hoo, you mean.
Yoo-hoo. What did I say? Yahoo?
Yoo-hoo and Manhattan Special sort of lived next to each other on the shelves in your refrigerator if you grew up in New York. But one had caffeine and the other was just like chocolate milk.
It was like a super watered down egg cream.
Yeah, that's very close.
Which, by the way, if people are confused, an egg cream does not have cream or egg. But it is maybe the greatest New York City cold dessertish style drink. And you have to experience one to believe how good it is. And of course, we have a video for those. So do yourself a favor if you've never had one, a New York style egg cream. It's basically a chocolate soda with benefits.
Nice. Do you use You Bet syrup?
I'm insulted by your question. You bet I do.
We used to play stickball in the schoolyard, and around the corner was a soda fountain, and we would get egg creams there. And we would only go once we broke the racquetballs that we were playing with. So like when you broke the ball, you'd have to go buy a new one, and they had a big bucket of them there. So you would go and you would buy a new one, you'd get an egg cream and then go back to the park. That was my childhood. But we have another poll.
Oh, great.
Yes. And it's a very simple one. I found these results a little bit more surprising than the ones from our first poll. And this one was, when you wake up, your first food craving is sweet or savory? And honestly, based on the amount of breakfast cereal and waffles and pancakes and all the things that people eat in the morning, the fact that our polls were overwhelmingly savory surprises me.
Well, it does not surprise me at all, because this is generational, my friend. We grew up with Pop-Tarts and cereal and donuts and Danishes. That was like completely normality for breakfast until people started, you know, I don't know, doing research and studies and checking hospital records and so forth. And then people were like, well, maybe a pound of sugar before lunch is not a good idea. And then, of course, the millennials came along.
Oh, them, yeah.
With their avocado toast and their healthy eating habits, which have benefited us all. I think we can agree. And I think there was a sea change that we're going to eat some meat. Fat's good now. Fat's not evil. It's okay to have some bacon on your avocado toast. And I think people just got away from the bowl of cereal for breakfast, just slowly but surely, part thank you food blogger and part just health trends in general. I think
this also says to us that our audience is overwhelmingly American, because when I'm in Europe, everybody's eating pastry for breakfast.
Yeah. And by the way, I have to interject here, because you were in Sicily recently.
Yes.
I'm going to do a takeoff on the famous Sicilian, sometimes breakfast, but snack food. It's, I think, maybe one of the world's first ice cream sandwiches, but they do the brioche with the granita or the sorbet inside.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Chocolate for the bun, maybe some, kind of green and red colored flakes of shaved ice cream to do the lettuce and the tomato. I'll paint some sesame seeds with a sugar syrup on a brioche bun. It's going to be, I think, a new taste sensation. So thank you, Sicilians. And thus concludes the Run It Up the Poll segment.
We're going to talk about the last best thing that I ate. And we're each going to take a turn here. And I would love for you to go first and tell me, what was the last best thing you ate?
The last best thing I ate was a little something I call the 900 degree hamburger. Let me explain. We have a wood-fired pizza oven, actually wood pellet to be exact, which gets up to 900 degrees or more if you let it, which is super good for cooking pizza. I'm sure you've experienced the wood oven pizza at some points of your life, like 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
And if done right, that is an amazing pizza. You get that little bit of smoke, but not too much. And it's just insanely good. But it also works for many other things. We roast salmon in there during the summers, fresh salmon from Bodega Bay is in season. We'll roast that in there, the best salmon you'll ever eat. But recently, I've been experimenting cooking burgers in there. Make an 8-ounce patty with a cast iron skillet. You don't need any lubrication, no grease, no nothing. The fat in the burger, we're using a nice ground chuck, probably 15, 20% fat content. You put that in that pan, you put it, pop it back in, literally for 1 minute, you flip it over, 1 minute more, test done this because you're probably done. And you will have a perfect medium rare, maybe just one shade towards medium. But the crust on that thing is insane. And that little bit of subtle, we use oak pellets, that little bit of subtle oak smoke that you would get, again, reminiscent of a wood-fired pizza, is just absolutely beautiful. And that burger was definitely the last best thing I ever ate.
Wow. I mean, I can't wait to get up to your place again to get me a 900-degree hamburger, because I definitely want that. And whatever bun we put it on, if we harken back to an old episode, I don't care. I'll eat it without the bun. That sounds amazing. Do you want to share with us the pizza oven that you actually own?
It's the...
That's what I thought you were going to say. I just wanted to make sure.
And it's the wood pellet. You'd be amazed how much heat will come off just a couple of cups of wood pellets. So apparently it's very efficient, possibly environmentally more friendly than the gas or the whatever else, the big, where you have to pile in all the wood and it has to just burn all the way, even if you're not cooking anything. These things burn out like in 15 minutes after you're done. Almost no cleanup. Now, I'm going to stop this endorsement / commercial until they're an actual sponsor, which I think they're very close.
We could just bleep it out.
We should bleep out until they start sending us checks. If you're listening, which it's a good chance you're not, but if you are, holler at your boys. We will sing your praises and maybe even get some social media video of Andrew eating a 900-degree burger, which I predict during the video he'll be rolling his eyes in pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. So we are inventing a new model for advertising. It's called extortion. You know, extortionatizing, something like that.
That's fine. They'll know who we're talking about, but they'll be so frustrated we beep them. They'll be like, fine, here's a check. Unbeep us, please.
Exactly.
And then we go back with the current technology. We can unbeep all the old shows.
That's right.
And maybe clean up some of my mistakes while we're there. But anyway, that's a different segment. What is your last best thing you ever ate?
So the last best thing that I ate was at a restaurant called Gorgiulo's. Now, Gorgiulo's is famous in Brooklyn, but that's not where I went. I was here in New Jersey and I was searching for a different place to eat because I end up going to the same places that are, you know, near or within walking distance to my house. And I wanted to try something new and I wanted to try something fun. So I started looking on OpenTable for restaurants and I see Gorgiulo's. I'm like, well, Gorgiulo's is in Brooklyn. This can't be the same place. And it so happens that in a town near where I live in New Jersey called Tinton Falls, there's a Gorgiulo's that is the sister restaurant of the one in Brooklyn. So I was like, well, let's give it a shot. So I went and on the specials menu, they had a piece of halibut that was seared to perfection. And I love halibut. It's my favorite fish. It's absolutely delicious. It's like a giant hunk of lobster meat if cooked properly. And then on top of it was chunks of snow crab. But wait, there's more. It is sitting in a bath of lobster bisque. It was completely and utterly decadent, delicious beyond anything that I've had recently. And it made me so happy because it was like that little taste of Brooklyn with the flair of the shore. And it was just perfect. It was such a great meal. And then the fun thing about this restaurant is this. They come to the table at the end of the meal. And before they bring you the check, they have this little like Yahtzee shaker.
The Liar's Dice Cups.
Right. Something like that. So they come over to the table and they say, pick a number between 1 and 69 or 1 and 70 or whatever the heck it was. So we agree upon a number and they shake the thing and then they pour one of these die on the table with a number on it. And if the number matches, your whole meal is free.
Wow.
And they do this every time you go there and they do the same thing in Brooklyn. So it's like an interesting gimmick that they've been doing for years and years and years. And every once in a while, you may get lucky. And shoot, if we had gotten lucky that night, we would have saved a couple hundred bucks.
Well, that sounds amazing. And a couple fun facts here. Halibut is by far the hardest piece of fish to cook, at least the fish that you see normally on menus, the top 10 fishes on a menu. It goes from perfection to inedible in maybe 15, 20 seconds, depending on how high heat you're using, because it's not super fatty. It seems richer than it is. So it doesn't have that little bit of forgiveness like a salmon. You know, you can go just a slightly over and yet it can still be moist and delicious and it doesn't wreck the experience. Halibut, when that goes over, it is dry and chalky and it is just not remotely the same experience. So it is a very unpopular piece of fish with chefs that work in high volume restaurants, especially the do catering. Someone says, you know, we want halibut for the wedding. It's like, oh, I'm so sorry. It's out of season. Like they'll just blatantly lie to the customer. And then the snow crab, I'll do any kind of fish top of crab. And then the lobster bisque at the bottom of the bowl of the plate. That's a really old school technique. Way back in the day was called sauce Americaine, which no, is not ketchup in French. So it is basically just all your shrimp shells and a few lobster shells, but generally in a restaurant, more shrimp shells than lobster shells, not to pull back the curtain too much. But at a seafood restaurant like that, you'll have more shrimp shells and so forth. But once you roast any kind of shellfish and then make a stock out of it and reduce it and enrich it with cream and tomato paste and so forth, it comes out incredibly delicious. So that sounds amazing. I would eat that anytime, anywhere.
Yeah, I'm going to try to recreate that at home. I know it'll probably cost me twice as much than eating it in the restaurant because I have to buy all those ingredients.
And then while you're eating, you'll be like, pick a number. Oh my God, this dinner is free.
It was totally free.
I like that concept. If I ever open a restaurant, which I won't, I'm going to do that. The dice will be loaded because I'm not an idiot, but it'll be a fun experience for the audience, even though no one will ever win.
Pairings is our favorite segment here at the Chef John podcast, where we talk about what we're watching and what it makes us want to eat. So, John, I want to let you go first because I have a feeling that mine is going to take a little while. There's a lot of splaining to do.
Okay. What I'm watching is Only Murders in the Building, and it is a very campy, which is what I call things I don't know how to describe that are not like super serious, a little bit over the top, kind of Broadway show tune-ish murder mystery sort of thing, but it's also a send-up of the true crime podcast culture. And it stars Steve Martin and Martin Short as the two buddies. Well, they're more frenemies in the show.
Two of the three amigos.
And they live in a classic upper west side apartment building that I'm pretty sure is a real building. They call it the Argonaut or something generic in the show. And oh my God, there's a murder in the building. And they are fanatical fans of true crime podcasts. So the two gentlemen and Selena Gomez form this trio of now they're going to solve the crime in the building while simultaneously recording a podcast. So it's actually unlike most true crime podcasts that happen after the crime and people just review what happened and try to keep you in suspense. They're doing it while the crime is still being solved. And the police, not to spoil anything here, because I think it's pretty obvious when you get into it, the police have written it off as a suicide, an obvious suicide. Nothing to see here, but Steve Martin's character and Martin Short, whose character is Oliver Putnam, they decide they're not having it. It was not a suicide. They are convinced it's a murder. The dude was in the elevator with them minutes before he died. And because they see the guy in the elevator right before this apparently happened, the suicide, and he was not very suicidal-ish. So that starts the ball rolling, and it's kind of funny, and it's kind of cute and entertaining. But only thing that wrecks it occasionally, and this is my same issue with every single thing Martin Short has ever done, like he'll have all the laugh out loud lines impeccably delivered, perfect timing, a complete pro. And then every once in a while, you can tell he ad-libbed something, and it is just so not funny and jarringly out of place. But he's Martin Short. What are they going to say? Hey, you can't riff like that. So there's some stuff in there that just blows me away with how unfunny some of his, what I hope, I really hope, were ad-libs. Otherwise, some comedy writer needs to get fired. Most of them are sight gags. Like at one point, he's holding the murder weapon, a knife, and he realizes it's the murder weapon, and he just throws it like up in the air and sticks in the ceiling. You're not doing that. No one's doing that. Not even Martin Short trying to get a laugh. And another point, he realizes he's talking to the murderer on a cell phone and he throws the cell phone. I buy dropping it or just like pulling your hands away, but like the full wind up and throw, it just seemed like, anyway, there's just a few moments like that I just cringed at, like, why it was going so well? Why did you do that? But Steve Martin's great in it. Selena Gomez is really good. I'm not going to say anything else about the plot or the murder or the murderers or the murders, because there's several things happen. There's two seasons, but very entertaining, often funny. I'm a sucker for anything filmed in New York that has lots of inside New York jokes. Like the president of the tenants association in the building is a total like fascist, you know, overbearing, all you know what or. And it's really well done with the character studies and so forth. The lovely and talented Nathan Lane also has a major role in this. He's a Greek gentleman that owns a chain of like delis, takeout food places. So Oliver is a semi-failed, washed up, burned out, has been of a show producer. And he sort of lives off the kindness of others now. And he says this in the show, and you're not sure if he means it literally, but he probably does. He lives on dips because they're inexpensive. And I think his buddy gives him dips from his store. And so he's always carrying dips. He claims he has not eaten an actual meal in like 10 years. And he always has dips. And it's usually, you know, baba ganoush or hummus. So he's living on this stuff. So, of course, my pairing for when you watch Only Murders in the Building would be an array of dips. And I would probably go classic Middle Eastern, Mediterranean style. But anyway, that to me would be the perfect pairing if you do watch Only Murders in the Building, which you should. Do a nice dip party, invite your friends over, watch a murder mystery and dip. What's the song? I dip, you dip, we dip. Whenever that song comes out at a wedding, I usually excuse myself to the bathroom, like when they do the electric slide, because I don't know the moves. A little embarrassing and awkward. But anyway, dips, Only Murders in the Building. I don't know if you're going to figure out who did it, but if you make the dips, people will know who did that.
Yes, you can find that show on Hulu, and make sure you put a napkin on your chest while you're eating the dips, because you really don't want to stain your shirt.
I think those are called bibs, but yes, thank you for the suggestion. I needed that a couple of days ago.
Well, my show is based on an old movie from 1973 called Westworld. Now, of course, the show I'm referencing is by the same name, Westworld. And basically, the original Westworld starred the most famous of the bald actors, because he was really the first fully bald actor to be in Hollywood and earning a living as a leading man, Yul Brynner. And basically, the general premise of the show is that very wealthy people have created a playland for very wealthy people to come and interact with these androids who look and act and behave just like human beings. So they go to act out all of their dark and demented fantasies on the residents of Westworld, who are all androids. So it's very sexual, it's extremely violent, and usually it's the very wealthy who have never had the experience of being told no. And now they go into these scenarios and they are like just monstrous, and they're treating the androids as disposable things. Now, obviously, this is a metaphor for other things in life, but this also has enormous star power on the show. So you have Evan Rachel Wood, you have Jeffrey Wright, you have Ed Harris, you have Thandi Newton, you have Tessa Thompson, you have James Marsden, Aaron Paul. You're just jam-packed with just tremendous performances, great actors. But the overall sort of sense is this struggle that we see in lots and lots of science fiction is the evolution of sentient robots, and how the androids from Westworld are developing a consciousness. And when they develop a consciousness, they become a problem. And the show migrates over the course of three or four seasons from this little town that's kind of set in the middle of the desert that has been created as a theme park, to then when the AIs sort of get out of the park and create havoc beyond that. So it's a fascinating show. It's an amazing deviation from the original film with Yul Brynner back in the 70s. And it's something that has really caught my interest because of my interest in science fiction, because the overall general themes of artificial intelligence what makes a person, what makes the idea of a sentient person. And of course, it's just brilliantly acted, beautifully filmed. It's really entertaining and interesting. So it really gets you thinking about the science fiction. You know, this all began with Asimov way back when he wrote iRobot, which then was turned into a film with Will Smith many years ago. But this theme, you know, went through Star Trek with Data. It went through a lot of different iterations. The cyberpunk stuff I talked about with William Gibson a few episodes back. It's all sort of tied together. And we're living in this world right now. We're living in a world where maybe the next evolution of, you know, human existence is artificial. And Westworld gives us a terrifying view of what that looks like. But it brings me to what I'm going to pair this with, because I really had to rack my brain a little bit. I'm like, what does this really make me want to experience? And I found something very interesting, John. I want to eat, or I at least want to experience, Connolly sauce cake. Connolly sauce cake is a artificial intelligence created recipe. There are a whole bunch of them that were generated by an AI, by Tom Brew's neural network. Now, of course, computers don't eat. So they don't really quite understand the nuance of the job that you do, John. So the idea that there is a cake out there that has been developed by an AI that is called a chocolate cake, but also includes things like chicken broth, garlic, onions, parsley, makes me realize that we really have nothing to fear, John.
No, I could have saved them some money and instead figure out how to get the computer to do that. We could have just put a bunch of words in a hat and you could have pulled out 15 of them and we could have said this was our AI recipe.
I think you're about right on that, because I could read to you some of the ingredients on this list, which is chicken broth, sesame seeds, parsley, vanilla, light red pepper sauce, ground cinnamon, more vanilla, more brown sugar, sugar, more pepper, some brie, garlic with the stems, margarine, an orange, onion, some heavy cream, coriander, and a little bit of salt. But wait, it gets better. Combine the flour, which isn't in the ingredient list, which is something I've experienced quite often as a food photographer.
Nice work, computers.
Grind about 1.5 inches of cold water combined with the chopped pecans. I have no idea where any of this is coming from. It's completely random. The AI is completely drunk and we are safe as humans. The Terminator is not coming for us, people, because they can't even execute a basic recipe. And without that recipe, how could you possibly explain how they could take our place? So Westworld is not real. It's not happening. This makes me feel better about my sci-fi sort of worries about the fact that we are turning into a technology-driven world that's going to envelop and swallow us all whole. But guess what? They can't cook. So we're safe.
Who knew that was the last hill we had to defend? The robots almost took over. And then... no bueno on the tuna casserole.
Nope. Because you know what? If they want to enslave us, they got to feed us. And if they're feeding us this stuff, we'll be gone in a week.
It's adorable you think they were going to keep us around for any reason at all once they go sentient. Although I've always pronounced it sentient. Am I totally wrong?
No, you're not. You could say it either way. But if you look at the Matrix, they might keep us as batteries. That's what they did.
Oh, that's true.
And I think what they were grinding up and feeding into their umbilical cords was a Connolly sauce cake.
Yes. Well, before you comment on my pairings, I will admit and go into yours a little bit because I've never seen Westworld. I've definitely seen parts of episodes because I do have HBO. So you can't help but see some of it because it's on all the time. And I assume it's won many Emmys. Is that correct?
I think it's definitely won some awards. Yeah.
So I know it's very well respected and critically acclaimed. And as you said, just a fabulous cast. Why I haven't gotten into it, I don't know. I can't explain. Some shows just are like that. Great shows that everybody loves, and I just don't get around to watching them. So I will eventually probably make my way through Westworld. I love the concept, and that's the kind of science fiction I enjoy. So yeah, maybe one day. Although when I do, when and if I enjoy it, I will not be enjoying any Connolly sauce cake, which they, of course, included some brie in there to bring out the garlic stem flavor. All right. As soon as we can move on from that, the better. So please, what do you think of Only Murders in the Building? Have you seen it?
I have not. And it seems really intriguing to me. And I love 2/3 of the Three Amigos. I mean, I've always loved both of those guys. I'm much more of a Steve Martin fan than I am of a Martin Short fan. But I can imagine that they've done so many things together and they work so well together that I could imagine the chemistry is just remarkable. So some of the shows that you've recommended for me, John, on the show here, I just got through with The Boys.
Yeah. Did you like it?
Oh my God. I couldn't get enough of it. I absorbed all three seasons in like four nights.
I thought it was just a genius twist on the superhero.
Oh, wow. It's such a good show. A lot of the shows you've recommended to me have become staples. So I'm going to just have to add this one to the queue. I'm going to take it sight unseen because you have built up a lot of goodwill in terms of all of the shows that you recommended to me that I've watched and enjoyed. I never run out of things to watch because I got Chef John.
I definitely suggest you check it out.
And I will grab a few dips while I'm at it.
Please do.
Well, that brings us to our top five list this week, John. And I went with something dear to my heart. And I know I've spoken of this before, and I thought I'd issue it as a bit of a challenge to you because you said you weren't much of a candy guy. And I had a feeling that there had to be something in there. There had to be some like latent memories of candy or things that really would spark your interest here. So this week's top five list is your top five candy choices. So John, I know you're not a big candy guy, but you got to have a top five.
I have a top five. I probably could do a top 15 with this. And let me explain what the deal is with candy.
Okay.
I don't enjoy candy, as I've expressed to you many times, but that's more of a as an adult thing. As I've said a million times on the show, your palate, your taste really does change over the years, sometimes very, very severely, which I will touch on when I get through my list. But when I was a young kid, candy was everything. Not that we were ever deprived as kids, but we didn't have like candy around the house. If you wanted candy, you had to use either your allowance. I think we got like a dollar a week, some nominal for, you know, doing whatever yard work, et cetera. And any other money you could make doing whatever, mowing somebody's lawn, or the most popular way we earned money was by collecting bottles and cans for deposit down at the drugstore or the soda fountains. We lived in a two town. It was one town, but it was like two little towns, Shortsville and Manchester. And there was like a soda fountain. Is that what they're called? Soda fountains?
Yeah.
It was like an old soda shop. Like they had the bar where they actually mixed up the soda with the syrup and the carbonated seltzer and so forth. And there was a place in Shortsville and a place in Manchester that would let you bring in your bottles and cans. They would give you cash and then they both sold candy. So we would collect all morning, getting, you know, 50 cents, 75 cents worth of goods together and go down there and cash them in. And then boom, there was the big rack of candy. And that was like, you were the master of your universe. You know, this was when you were just in charge. You didn't have to ask the parents for the money, get permission to buy it. It was just your money. You could get any candy you wanted. Didn't matter if it was 10 minutes before dinner, who would know? So at that point in my life, I was just a candy fanatic. So this list goes back to then. Now, I don't know if I could do a top five list. I'd rather have an extra piece of, you know, 900 degree hamburger. But back then, we will start with number five, Mr. Goodbar, a very basic candy, milk chocolate with peanuts.
That's it.
With a very equally boring yellow wrapper and a little sidebar here. I remember, I don't know how old I was, big fan of the Mr. Goodbar. And then I was at a friend's house and I don't know if it was his mom or his sister or his aunt. There's a book on the table called Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Also a movie.
And definitely not about candy.
Nope.
So Mr. Goodbar was one of my favorites. I'm a big chocolate peanut butter combo fan. When we are talking sweets and desserts, I'll do that combo anytime. Number four, Tootsie Rolls. Love the Tootsie Roll. Tootsie Roll might have been my favorite Halloween candy to get because it was already that size. There was no funny business. It wasn't like you had to settle for a much smaller candy bar than you were used to. Tootsie Rolls were always that little size. And the concept of a piece of chocolate that ate like a piece of caramel, I thought was just genius. I didn't probably think it through that deeply at the time, but I really liked the textural aspect of the Tootsie Roll. And it was kind of caramely, but it was definitely chocolate. And you seemed to be able to eat them for a really, really long time. Like it lasted. And then I don't know, again, how old I was when you first discover the giant Tootsie Roll. Do you see that? And you're like, wait a minute. They have a 6-7 inch long Tootsie Roll? This changes everything. Coming in at number three, The Junior Mints movie. What's it called? Theater? I've been there so long. I forgot what they're called.
Yes, a theater. It's called the theater.
Junior Mints, one of my favorite movie theater snacks. Although in the theater, you cannot enjoy them in their best, most optimal state, which is, of course, frozen, as everybody knows. And obviously, one of the great Seinfeld episodes of all time, Junior Mint. So yeah, Junior Mint. I love a good chocolate mint. I don't like mint sweet, but I will make an exception for dark chocolate little nuggets of Junior Mint formatting. I could eat those. When you freeze them, they're really stiff and chewy and extra delicious. Number two, Almond Joy, which, you know, can be a very polarizing candy bar for some reason I don't understand. And I think from even an early age, I realized, maybe on a very subconscious or maybe alternative plane of consciousness, that these were better than the other crap we would eat. It had the chocolate, antioxidants, as we came to find out later. It had coconut, pretty good for you. And it had almonds, which were great for you. So even back then, without even knowing it, I think I was gravitating towards maybe getting away from bad candy and to maybe a more savory application. And I just loved that there was a very specific way to eat it. Almond Joy comes in two sections, as you well know. So you get two pieces, two little mini candy bars in the pack. So I always love that. And each candy bar of the two candy bars had two almonds on it, perfectly spaced. So it was eaten in four bites. Unless you really wanted to savor it, then it was eight bites. You try to bite that almond right in half, and that was bite one. Then you'd finish that first almond. Then you go to bite three, bite four, and so forth, as I give candy bar eating directions to people. Which brings us to number one, Boston baked beans.
What?
Yeah, exactly. This is on the list for several reasons. One, I know you and our lovely and talented producer are big time Yankees fans.
Mm-hmm.
So even the word Boston, you're like, well, why did you say Boston?
My dog is a Boston Terrier and we call him a Yankee Terrier in the summer.
Sounds about right. So I chose it for that reason. Only 2% of the reason is that, but still a pretty good reason. Also, I usually like to at least once or three times during the show date myself, because you got to be in my age range, like 50 or over, to even know what a Boston baked bean is. You young kids will have to Google it, but they came in a box. And yes, the box said Boston baked beans. And they're a peanut covered in a really super crispy, like suspiciously crispy. Like, how did they do that? That can't be real food. Very thin candy coating on the peanut. There was this exact color of a bright reddish brick red baked bean. And they're crunchy and they're sweet and there's a peanut inside. So imagine a peanut M&M without the chocolate. If you're trying to envision what it's like eating a Boston baked bean, but even crunchier and crispier. Of a shell of a coating. Absolutely delicious. You never see them anywhere, except I know there's websites where you can buy old, you know, nostalgia, retro candies and stuff. But the Boston baked bean was probably my favorite childhood candy. Another thing you could get at the movies, one of the few places you could find it. So I'd get my Boston baked beans, my Junior Mints, watch the movie, and that was it.
Wow, John, I'm really impressed with your list. Let me just go from the top, because the whole concept of the candy store also rings very true in my childhood, where there was the penny candy corner store and we would go and, you know, we'd have a couple of nickels or a couple of dimes or a couple of quarters to go to the candy store. And however you got that money, you know, beg, borrow, steal, sell something, you know, whatever it was, that money always ended up at that corner store. And we would get all kinds of different candy there. And that was the big highlight of the day. And just recently, my godson was in town. He's a 10-year-old boy and he wanted candy. And we were on the Lower East Side in New York. And they have a store there, which is called Economy Candy, where they sell all the candies you can possibly imagine, including a lot of novelty stuff in this like sort of almost wholesale environment. And it's just packed wall to wall, all the way up to the ceiling with candy, all the aisles, candy, 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 everywhere you go. And the kid, his eyes just like popped out of his head and of course gets overwhelmed with decisions and didn't really get a whole lot of things, but he ended up with a bag full of loose candy, which was really cool because it was a lot of fun memories in watching him experience that. But let's go from five, John, because Mr. Goodbar is something that I only really remember being in the minis. You know, when you get the big bag of mixed Hershey bars.
Yeah, yeah.
There was the Crackle and you got the Hershey's Milk.
Special Dark, which everyone threw away.
Special Dark, everyone threw that one away. You know, nobody wanted that. And then a Mr. Goodbar and they were all in the same bag. And, you know, you'd go through and pick them out. And, you know, like Mr. Goodbar was not one of my favorites, but it is the combination that I really like. I like peanut butter and chocolate, as you'll see when we get to my list. If we go to number four, Tootsie Rolls, you know, are one of those candies that you just have so many memories attached to them. You know, you can almost feel them sticking to your molars, like as you're chewing on. And my niece was a candy freak growing up, and the Tootsie Roll was her favorite thing. So like if there were Tootsie Rolls anywhere in the house, she would find them. She was like a bloodhound. But the Tootsie Rolls have that magnetic draw. And when you talk about that giant 7-ounce chunk,
the police baton version,
it's a crazy piece of candy, and you can't just bite one piece off and then just put it away. Of course, that's what you're supposed to do, but no, you can eat the whole thing. Man, it's not quite chocolate, it's not quite taffy, who knows what it really is, but it's part of our growing up and we love it. You've lost me at Junior Mints though. My brother was the big Junior Mints guy. He would always get them at the movies, just like you would. I would also keep them in the freezer. There was always Junior Mints around. I absolutely hated them. I'm not a mint guy. I don't like mints. I feel like mints are something that goes on the pillow or you eat after dinner to cleanse your palate. Definitely not a treat or a snack that I look forward to. I cannot stand mint chip ice cream. Maybe I'm a sacrilege or a communist or something. I don't know, but I'm going to put up the big X on the Junior Mints.
I'm generally with you on everything you just said, except for that very specific Junior Mint, which maybe just was from childhood movie memories, nostalgia. So who knows?
I mean, the combination too. I'm not as much a dark chocolate aficionado. I'm much more of a milk chocolate. And that's definitely more of a dark chocolate sort of endeavor. So I'm going to have to leave the Junior Mints on the counter. But number two, John, your Almond Joy. I'm with you all the way. I love the combination of almonds and chocolate and coconut. I absolutely love it. I'll do the Mounds bar as well, because sometimes you feel like a nut.
Sometimes you don't. And it's funny you mentioned that, because, you know, I always test out my list on Michelle so she can tell me what I really should put. She's like, you're going Almond Joy and not Mounds? She knows I love dark chocolate, and I absolutely love dark chocolate with coconut. That is one of the classic combos of all time. So she was shocked I went with Almond Joy. Then I explained the childhood and the nuts and the whole thing.
The ice cream shop on the boardwalk here in Asbury Park, they sell Coconut Castaway. And basically Coconut Castaway tastes just like an Almond Joy. It's coconut ice cream with chunks of chocolate in it, topped with almond.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
But I also like the fact that you gave us multiple biting techniques that we could take away.
A 4-bite and 8-bite.
4-bite, 8-bite. But you forgot the one that I like the most, and the one that most children would engage in readily. Shove the whole thing, both pieces.
Both pieces. Probably did that once or twice.
I just want to get to your number one, because I have to be completely and utterly honest. I never heard of those.
Oh my God.
When you put that on there, I thought you were making a joke. I thought you were making a joke, because when you make baked beans, it has so much sugar in it. So I thought you were making a joke. So while you were saying it, I looked it up and I saw the box and I confirmed that I had never seen that before. So the next time I go to Economy Candy, the next time I have a child around that I have an excuse to go to Economy Candy, I'm going to buy you a box and we're going to eat them when we do our show together at the end of the season.
It's a date.
Well, that brings me to my list, John. There's a definite theme here. Number five, M&M peanut. Now, chocolate and peanuts are clearly the combination of choice here between you and I. I love milk chocolate and M&M peanut with the candy shell and the silly commercials before the movie and everything about them. I love M&M peanut. I have a jar of them in my house because I buy them at Costco in that giant plastic box. So I have a nice antique ball jar filled to the absolute top with M&M peanut. Number four, Tootsie Pops. So we're also in league on the Tootsie Roll, which of course is at the center of the Tootsie Pop. But how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? Three. Of course, because the owl told us so as we were children watching Saturday morning cartoons, and that commercial would always come up. But I have another special connection to the Tootsie Pops. When I was producing the film that I worked on back in 2018, both the director and I had candy preferences, and our PAs would every day bring us candy, which is why both of us gained 15 pounds during the making of this movie. And he would get a big thing of Sour Patch Kids every day, and I would get a Tootsie Pop, and the PAs would bring it to us and I would have it. And at the end of the filming, I reached in my pocket and I had one left. And I actually saved it. And it's the red one, of course, because the logo and all of the marketing materials for the movie were in red. So the red Tootsie Pop is in my drawer with all the other sort of memorabilia from when we made the movie. So I have the connection as a child and the connection as an adult. Number three is one that came a little bit later in life, and I love the Ritter Sport milk chocolate with cornflakes. This is such a dynamic, delicious candy bar. The chocolate is really high quality. Ritter is a German company, and they make it with cornflakes in the chocolate. It's so delicious. It's one of my favorite candies. They sell it at the high-end grocery market that I would always shop at for photo shoots. So like whatever I was buying a bunch of stuff on the client, I'd be throwing a couple of Ritter Sports in the basket just to have them in my house and in my studio. Oh man, I absolutely love this one. And if you've never had that combination of chocolate with cornflakes, you have to go for it. It's really good. And that brings me to number two, John, Snickers. There is nothing as good as a Snickers when you really want one. And the whole idea about the hungry and whatever, yeah, it's totally true. And I love the commercials where the people turn into other people and it's just really hysterical. But a Snickers is just such a classic candy bar and you can eat it in so many different ways. Because eating it when it's like soft and mushy, great. Eating it when it's frozen, solid, and you break a piece off, hopefully not break your teeth, also amazing. It's just such a great candy bar. It's so well designed to eat in so many different ways. I chop it up. I put it on ice cream. I could live on Snickers. I mean, you know, probably wouldn't live that long, but I could live on it. And that brings me to number one, John. If there was ever a doubt in anybody who's ever heard me talk or watched me eat, you would know that number one is the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. I have devoted much of my eating time and energy into acquiring and eating in multiple ways, both frozen, refrigerated, and not the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. The combination of the peanut butter and the chocolate is one of my favorites. I listed it in our top five of favorite food combinations. Also have another nice connection here is I actually got to film some commercials as a director for Reese's and the peanut butter cups at a certain point in my career a few years ago. And we did a whole series on Halloween candy. And it was a lot of fun. And then I was left with literally bags and bags and bags of this stuff.
Nice.
Kept them in my freezer, had peanut butter cups for at least a year. So if I looked a little portly around 2017, you know exactly why.
I was wondering. I didn't really notice it until I saw you in your wetsuit. Well, that's a great list. No surprise with the copious amounts of peanuts and chocolate combining together. The M&M peanut, also one of my favorite candies as a kid. In fact, if I did my adult top five list, absolutely peanut M&M makes the list. Now, texturally, there's an experience you can only get with a peanut M&M. It is very difficult to explain, but I will try now. I'm assuming you pop these in your mouth and just chow them down, just crunch through as quick as you can.
Multiple techniques, but that's one of them.
If you ever want to do the, what should we call it? The Zen method. No, it would be more tantric method for eating the peanut M&M. You slowly savor it on your tongue and the coating will slowly melt and you get closer and closer to the chocolate. But if you're very careful and you evenly dissolve it, you will get down to this impossibly thin, but still crisp layer of candy coating around the chocolate. We're talking microns thick. And when you get to that stage, biting through that to the chocolate and peanut, because it's just a little bit crisp and very thin, because that's the sweetest part of the bite. Most of that's gone. And you get just that little bit of crisp sugar crust, crisp layer, then the chocolate, then the peanut. That is one of my favorite candy bites of all time. You got to want it. It takes some work. If you can catch it at that sweet spot, pun intended, right before it completely dissolves, it's a new experience.
Well, and it also turns white.
Exactly. White with like cracks, like a 1,000-year-old egg.
We've thought a lot about candy in our lives.
Tootsie Pop, love Tootsie Pop because I like Tootsie Rolls. Red, for whatever reason, I think they all tasted exactly the same. But red was definitely the best Tootsie Pop.
My favorite was orange.
Interesting. See, orange was my least favorite. I liked the red and I liked the chocolate on chocolate. Although it tasted more like root beer for whatever reason, which is really bad chocolate. But anyway, the Tootsie Pop, the red pop, loved it. But my issue with it, and it's not even an issue, I found it amusing. When you get down to the end, you're at some point eating the paper stick with that last bite or two of the still attached Tootsie center. And you don't quite know where Tootsie roll center ends and paper begins.
Right.
Probably not the most awesome edible paper ever made. Ritter Sports Bar's a fan of the candy bar. I love their marzipan stuffed dark chocolate. They have ones that have fruits and nuts. It's like eating a healthy meal. I don't know, although I'm going to say I have at some point, I just don't remember ever having the chocolate cornflake infused one, but I can imagine it's amazing.
Yep.
And I just, while you were chatting there, I actually just put that on my production calendar under my idea list for a chocolate cornflake infused homemade chocolate bars.
Ooh.
So I'm going to have to post that. Fair warning that probably will be done with dark chocolate, but that's just how I roll. But yeah, I can see that crisp, sweet, starchy with the chocolate and the bitter working with this. Yeah, that's going to work on every level. Oh, and I'm speaking of foodie sidebars. There was a famous ice cream maker in San Francisco, I'm sure you've heard of, Humphrey Slocum, that does an ice cream called Secret Breakfast. And it's vanilla ice cream with cornflakes and a shot of bourbon.
Oh, all right.
Hence the name Secret Breakfast. I don't know. So when I saw the word cornflakes in your list, I thought of that ice cream. Number two, Snickers bar, classic. I would have picked it. It's one of my favorites, but I knew it was going to be on your list 100%. So I let you have it.
Thank you.
It is a complete food. Four food groups are in there somewhere. It has to be some kind of lard or something they mix in the nougat or in the caramel mixture. But yeah, it's perfect in every way. Every temperature, agreed, frozen. Used to put them in the freezer. And in fact, the Snickers bar ice cream version is underrated for a frozen treat. And then number one, I can't even do my jokes about Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, how it was created, because we did that last time it was on one of your lists. But if you missed that, a guy was riding a bike and then hit another person carrying the chocolate and they ran into each other. Anyway, it was a whole thing. They were mad at each other initially. Oh my God, you got peanut butter in my chocolate. You got chocolate in my peanut butter. They worked it out. And long story short, that's number one on Andrew's list. So I enjoy that. Who doesn't like that? And I told you, one of my go-to midnight snacks, a tablespoon of peanut butter sprinkled with chocolate chips. You can make your own Reese's peanut butter cup in a couple seconds right out of your pantry. So yes, I love a good peanut butter cup. And I do like the little mini ones also.
I want to venture into just one last thing before we drop candy.
Yeah.
I want to have an honorable mention.
What's that?
It describes my physique as a child. Chunky.
Chunky bar. I always thought that was a trick. They were trying to get us to eat dried fruit with our candy.
I loved it. I loved the chunky bar.
Because at a certain age, when you're young, it's just something chewy. You don't know there's like raisins or whatever, there were currants in there. And then you're like, when you're like 7 or 8, you're like, wait a minute, there's raisins in this. What the hell? I'm good for that with an honorable mention. But if you get to get an honorable mention, I do. Necco wafers, as I date myself again.
Oh, that's funny. I was out at an old-fashioned ice cream shop with a friend, and I was treating. And I was like, hey, let me get the ice cream. And she goes, okay, fine, but you got to buy me those Necco wafers too, because I haven't seen them in so long and I want to buy them for her son. And so I ended up buying her the pack of chocolate Necco wafers. No, it was the mix.
They're impossible to describe flavor and texture-wise, so I'm not going to try. They're weird. They're strangely addictive. You have no idea what flavor they are. Everything about them is odd and weird, and like where they came from, why they exist, nobody really is quite sure. It's spelled weird. It's like N-E-C-C-O. What? Anyway, if you get really bored with life, go find some Necco wafers and tell me what you think.
Well, that brings us to the last segment of our show. And what we have for you is a peek behind the curtain. A peek behind the curtain is the adventures that John and I have had being visual artists with food. I'm going to start tonight with mine because I want to talk a little bit about working on a commercial set with food photography. So when I first started in food photography, I worked editorially. And what we got was recipes, and what we ended up with was pictures, which is the experience that a lot of food photographers have when you're working with food in a studio. And then I started working commercially in advertising. And we were working for a frozen food company, which will remain nameless. And what we were doing was we were having to make this frozen food look, appetizing for a commercial shoot. And obviously, I was just assuming that they would just send us the frozen food. We would defrost it and make it as usual and then try to do the best we could to make it look pretty. No, that's not how it works. And I found it really interesting how it actually worked. So we hired this famous food stylist, but his name was Rick Ellis. And what Rick would do is he would get all the component parts of the frozen foods from the company before they actually went into the food. And he would go through each package of these and pick out like individual peas and individual carrots and individual little pieces of things. It was remarkable to me that it was just so detailed and that it was deconstructed that way. And then I worked with him on another job where that wasn't available. So we actually had to use the frozen foods in the way that I thought we were going to do it, which was, oh, they gave us the frozen food and we'll do the best we can. But doing the best we could was then Rick taking every single frozen food apart. So he would defrost them, then pick out all of the ingredients, rinse them off, and then reassemble them again. So like everything you see, like because of truth in advertising, right? So you can't put things in the food that doesn't actually appear in the ingredient list. So there's an integrity issue there. Somebody like Rick was such an artist at creating something out of nothing, you know, where he would make something just incredibly beautiful out of a bunch of frozen food, but it would take him like 8 or 10 boxes of this stuff to make one plate of food that looked edible for photography. And the other time that we worked together, again with Rick, was with a tuna fish commercial. The art director from the advertising agency gave what we call a comp to the client. And the comp he created in Photoshop, where he took a circle section of a beautiful piece of tuna that had been cooked and cut it out in Photoshop and dropped it in the can and made it look like this beautiful piece of tuna with all the circles and the lines in it that was living inside the tuna can. Now, of course, the client saw this and was like, oh, that's beautiful. We have to make that. Now, of course, if you've ever opened up a can of tuna fish, it does not look like that ever. And we ended up having to open up something like 65 or 70 cans of tuna, taking pieces and parts of it. And Rick was reassembling them to make it look like that comp image for the client. And it was just incredibly awful because we had two studios going. We had a video side and we had a still photography side. And in the middle was where the clients were sitting with all the monitors. And all three of these rooms just reeked of tuna fish, because we were disassembling can and can after can after can just to get enough pieces to make it look like what they call the puck. So the beauty of food photography that you experience maybe, you know, 40 or 50 times a day, whether it be TV or magazines or newspapers or the internet, there are plenty of people besides the photographer that go into making that food look beautiful. And when you get somebody who's as skilled as a commercial food stylist working with you and realizing just how amazing what they do is, that is a true peek behind the curtain, because man, without that guy, I can't make that picture. So hats off to food stylists out there.
Well, amen to that, because as someone that doesn't do any food styling for my final shots and damn proud of it, it's been one of my running gags. Sometimes I accidentally get a good shot. Most times I don't and don't care, but I have seen professionals work and it is awe-inspiring what they can do. So I totally related to everything you were saying. Now, did you at least make a giant 75 cans worth of tuna salad and, you know, give it to the crew? Like what?
No. The smell in the room was just, nobody ate tuna for 6 months after that.
All right. Well, that's understandable. But yes, what you see in the final billboard or ad or thing on the subway car, they didn't just open one package and dump it on the plate. And then Andrew walked over and was like, all right, let's go with 100 ISO. Okay, boom. Put it in the can. We're done. There's a lot of work that goes into that. And it's really, really hard. And interesting about the truth in advertising, because I know you hear the stories of food stylists and photographers painting turkeys with shoe polish for the ad. You can only do that if it's like a magazine cover for the recipe, because you're not selling them the turkey. But if you were selling a turkey, like a restaurant or a wholesaler of turkeys would say, like, here's our cooked turkey, and they were painted with shoe polish, that would be not kosher.
Right.
All right. Well, I'm pulling back the curtain. I'm just going to get right into it. The hardest thing for any video recipe producer by far is not the food styling. It's not the actual cooking. It's none of that stuff. It's working with plastic wrap. Anyone without a camera rolling can walk over, pull a piece of plastic wrap off a Saran Wrap or Glad or whatever your favorite brand is. And by the way, if they're listening, we would love to include you in our podcast and we won't beep out your names. But if you try to do it on camera, there is a 100% chance by the time you pull it off and you've cut it on the cutter and you're moving that 2 feet over to the plate that you're now filming, like, all right, now we're going to wrap this up and pop in the fridge to chill for 2 hours. So you're doing that shot. As soon as you go to place that over the plate or the bowl or the pan, somehow a breeze will catch the corner or your finger will just move the wrong way and it will double over itself. And then you start to put it down and then you try to fix it. But now, because your brain is thinking about a different thing, except cover this pan and get it in the fridge, you're hesitating and you have false starts. And now you're trying to unfold it and fix the flaw. But now you're thinking, should I keep going with this? In an 8-minute food video, you don't want a minute to be the wrapping of the bowl. That is just bad. No one came onto YouTube like, I would like to watch a video of someone wrap plastic over some food. So usually what you end up doing, and I think anyone that does video recipes is like nodding, hopefully in agreement out there in the audience, you end up wadding it up, turning off the camera, deleting that file, tearing off another piece, staging it next to you, perfectly unfolded, turning the camera back on. All right, now we're going to wrap this whatever and pop in the fridge for a couple hours to chill. And you go to do it again, and the exact same thing will happen. Somehow, some way, it will catch on the edge of the counter. Or, you know, just like sports. If someone's a fumbler, the worst way to fix that is to tell them not to fumble. Like, don't think about fumbling. You can't play scared. You'll manifest those errors. And it just, it's like reverse positive visualization. So as I'm afraid of screwing up with the Saran Wrap, I'm actually making it happen. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the camera's off, no one's watching, I can tear off a piece of plastic wrap, you know, like a champ and cover anything and it never screws up. Or because I don't care how it looks and it always looks great and it's perfectly seamless. But when I'm filming it, it is an absolute horror nightmare, just cluster of a you-know-what. And I can't do it. It usually takes me 3 to 4 attempts to wrap anything you've seen on Food Wishes that has plastic wrap on it. There was no way that was a one take.
But you write the recipes. Why don't you just not do recipes that have Saran Wrap?
Well, when you get to chill things, you don't want to skin. Like I recently posted a mascarpone recipe. And at some point you put it in the strainer and you need to put a little piece of plastic over that so it doesn't form a skin, oxidize. And that took me like 3 takes. To put that stupid piece of plastic on. So it's just like internal debate all the time. The camera's filming, your hands going like back and forth, hesitating and not knowing what to do. And it comes through the final production when someone watches it, like, that looked weird. So I end up starting over. So it sounds like such a minor thing. And it really is, you know, compared to famine and, you know, wars, et cetera. But for a video recipe chef, plastic wrap is the bane of our existence.
And now we're at the end of another episode of the Chef John podcast. But before we go, we need to know, what did we learn today, John?
Well, we learned a tremendous amount, a lot of it about candy, which I'm just going to skip because I don't want people knowing too much about candy. Kids, don't eat too much candy. Stay in school. But what we learned, I think, is surprisingly, and I was shocked, coffee is the most popular drink at breakfast. I mean, who knew? That was news we broke here on the Chef John podcast. Thanks to our, as you know, one of my favorite segments, the Run It Up, what is it? Run It Up the Post? Run It Up the Poll?
Run It Up the Poll.
Yeah, so thank God for that, which is a good segue into all food photography basically is a lie. Is that fair?
I mean, it's not unfair.
Okay, then it's fair, apparently. So the picture's gorgeous, the photography impeccable, but there's a really good chance that that is not what that TV dinner looked like coming right out of the package.
Yeah, that's 100%.
It might have been 14 to 17 different TV dinners that they picked through to get the perfect peas and carrots.
Yep.
We also learned that, speaking of breakfast and coffee, you did not have coffee until you were 30 years old.
Yeah.
And related to that, you will not have eaten Boston baked beans candy until you're over 50 years old.
This is correct.
So, wow, you're late bloomer in those two departments. And then I think we'll finish up with what really is the most important, most profound thing we learned today, that AI, which stands for artificial intelligence, is sometimes AS, artificial stupidity. Because if you're going to let an AI bot come up with a recipe that includes brie, coriander, vanilla, sugar, more sugar, and it's a chocolate cake, but doesn't have any chocolate, I would not call that intelligence, artificial or otherwise.
John, I feel really relieved with that, because when I saw your show notes that said sentient AI is really AS, I thought you were talking about me.
No. I would never call you intelligent.
Oh.
Artificial intelligence, not to be confused with actual real intelligence, like you clearly display on a regular basis on this show.
Thank you.
And I am working up to. But, you know, I'm getting there. I've been reading more. Well, that's not true. I've been remembering things I've read more thanks to you and your insights. All right. That's it. Thank you for listening. We love the support. We hope you enjoy this. If you don't, leave us a 5-star rating anyway and a comment telling us why you don't. As long as you give the 5-star rating, we're fine with it. And that's it. I had a good time. Andrew, I hope you had a good time.
Yep.
And there's only one thing left to do, and that's say goodnight, Andrew.
Good night, Andrew.